Heidi received her MA in Spiritual Theology from Regent College, with a special focus on the spirituality and social justice orientation of medieval women. The wisdom of the women who came before us has shaped Heidi's vocation of 15 years at Servants Anonymous Society. That's a Calgary agency supporting sexually exploited women. In the life skills classroom, overnights in program houses, and in her role as senior program advisor, Heidi has learned a great deal from the women and their children and about the importance of true hospitality. These learnings continue to inform her life, her writing, and her work, and they are the core of her passion for coming alongside people on the margins of society. Heidi's also a regular contributing author to Weavings, which is a U.S. Journal of Spirituality. I actually hope to have a stack of those here, but like is normal in my life, I can't find them. But I will commend that publication to you. It's a really fantastic publication, and when I saw that, I was even more impressed than I already was. So, Heidi, you're my hero, and I'm really pleased to welcome you, and let us welcome Heidi.
Well, good morning. I'm really, really honored to speak to you today, and I want to thank my friend Betty Jane. I met Betty Jane quite a long time ago, and I'm grateful because it's been lots of good things have come as a result. And I've heard from Betty Jane about your community and its goodness and its heart for coming alongside people who are marginalized. So I'm doubly honored to meet you in person. And also, it's an honor for me to share and pass on what I've learned from the women at Servants Anonymous. It feels really important to me to do that because they're very, those who are with us and those who passed are very, very wonderful, brave women who taught me a great deal. And it seems important to share what they had to say. I have two images that kind of drove my writing of this presentation. And one is of women, the women that I met as servants who worked really, really hard to overcome difficult experiences that shaped their identity. I was talking with Hannah and Michaela and Natalie about identity before we started, and when someone's been hurt, when I've been hurt, and maybe for you too, your identity gets kind of distorted. And for women and boys who've been really hurt in sexual exploitation, your identity's just gone. So that image of some of the women who came through the doors of Servants with their identity really distorted has driven me these last weeks in preparing for today. And the other image I have is of people, really, really good people, who are drawn to come alongside people who have been hurt, who have heard cries from the street at the conference in PEI or other times. And I've learned from the women at Servants, both those who made it and are doing extremely well, and those who've passed away, a little bit about what helps and what can accidentally add weight to those climbing out of the pit. In support of people who feel called to reach out their helping hand, I think the people in this room and others, I will share what I learned about pit hospitality. And it occurred to me yesterday that that would be a good title for this talk too, pit hospitality. I'll briefly just share. I'm not at Servants anymore, but I'd like to share a little bit about how I came to be there. Are people familiar with what Servants Anonymous is as an agency? No? Yes? I'll explain. It's a very community-based agency that's in Inglewood now, and it used to be down below Cups downtown on 7th. What I like about Servants is that it's a long-term program for women who've been sexually exploited and their children. So there's a day program, 6 to 12 months long at least, so it's not a 28-day get your skills and go apply them. It's free housing, free childcare on site. I think it's the only agency that has free childcare on site, because for lots of women who make the decision to leave the street, it's a hard decision to make when you don't like yourself, because it's a lot of work to become well for any of us. But when you really don't like yourself, sometimes it feels like it's that you're not a valuable enough person to apply that effort to. But when you have a child, you think, I better get it together, because I don't want to happen to the child what happened to me. And so it was really important to have on-site daycare. We had businesses, social enterprises, so that when the women graduated, they could practice in a safe environment, job skills, learn that bosses get mad and are grumpy, and that's how the world is, and that stories are okay, and you show up at work the next day. So it was a good, safe place to practice. So I really liked being there. I was there for about 15 years. Started in the classroom. We did creative writing on Mondays. We did math, which I'm horrible at, on Tuesdays. And we went to the gym on Fridays when I first started volunteering. And then after about 3 months of volunteering, I left my job at the Canadian Cattlemen's and came on as staff. And I think it's why I left. I really, and that informs this talk, I really, really wanted, when I met these women, I went, I need to be here. I'd heard the founder speak at a gathering like this at my mother-in-law's church, Grace Presbyterian. And when the founder spoke about why she started up Servants, I felt like something actually flooded through me, like my blood went whoosh, whoosh. And I thought, I need to not only be about cows, I need to, this has been great, but I need to go there. And she'd heard God say to her, go get my kids. Just like St. Francis heard, repair my church. And she took it really literally, just like he did, and she started bringing women into her home. So Servants started that way, not with anyone's educational qualifications to do this, but just people who thought this isn't okay. So I started just as a volunteer, and I ended up staying for 15 years. I had to go when our own family had to relocate quickly, and in terms of some hardship in our family, some of our closest supports were women from Servants, maybe from 10 years prior. So there are some really important friendships that I'm grateful for. So that's a quick snapshot that I hope sets the scene for why I want to talk about meaningful ways of helping people who are hurt. You know, the snapshot is a middle-class background, our life is pretty stable, I had a great job. I didn't have any lived experience myself on the street. I didn't have a social work background. But I found out, and this is what's the most important part is that I had everything in common with the women in the classroom. I learned that helping someone who's broken is not about having the right skills or making no mistakes or implementing a program properly. I learned actually at the end that the more mistakes, the better. I used to tell that to new staff when they came in wanting to do a good job. And I'd say, actually, if you could try to make as many mistakes as you can, that would be best. And if you could just show up the next day, because that's what I learned from my first supervisor at Servants. Because when you don't think you're good at anything, and none of the girls at Servants ever had a soccer medal or a poem they wrote in school put on the fridge, nothing like that. So you think that everyone else is good at things, all the normal people, that's what the women would say, normal people, not realizing that all of us are insecure and often not good at things. So I learned that mistakes are good, because it helps the women equalize, that it's okay. I learned that in the journey together, offering places of belonging that require us to choose to make room, even adapting our own identities is really, really important. And that's a risky thing to say, but I think assuming wellness and good boundaries are a given, in any relationship, but I think making room for people who don't feel like they belong requires us to literally make room in our own sense of who we are. And then transformation occurs. So this is what I believe. I believe hospitality is about meeting the divine in our neighbor. If I had to say one sentence about this talk, it would be that. And this requires us to see people who present themselves as very broken as a neighbor with whom we have much in common, and to trust that God meets us at the site of our wounds. So to be open about our own woundedness, not putting it all out there on the first day, but not being so different than the people that we're seeing ourselves in a helping position with. So a lot of what I would have to say today will be a gifting of stories of women, because I think it's easier to take in things through story, and it is their wisdom I would offer today, not mine. So it's kind of a collage of their stories and my reflections on the significance of them. So my take-home message would be this. Pitt hospitality is all about mutuality and being vulnerable, willing for the shape of our identity to be altered in order for someone else to find a place of belonging. Pitt hospitality allows the one whose identity has been squashed to discover that she is needed, to discover that she is a delight, and to own her own name. In the pit, we meet the divine by engaging our neighbor, stranger become friend. And because God is close to the brokenhearted, because God is in the pit with us, we both climb out transformed. So I could go now. I mean, that's really what I want to say, but maybe now I just tell you some stories. First of all, I would ask, is it helpful for me to talk about why a girl ends up on the street, or is that something? No, you're nodding? Okay. And Hannah and Michaela and Natalie, if you want to jump in, because you learned a lot at your conference too. I'll just say a few ways this happens. Sometimes it's about a girl or a boy. I really want to include boys, because they're the lonely ones in Calgary too. There's nothing for boys. You're lonely and you're not fitting in at school and you're not clicking with your parents, and you go to the mall and meet a really nice guy or girl who buys you fries and sits with you and hangs out and says, you look really good in that coat, let's go try it on. Oh, you look so good and you have to have it. I'm gonna get it for you, it's a gift. We're having a party tonight, why don't you come? And that happens for a little while, and all of a sudden, you owe me $2,000. I can think of a way you can pay it back and we can still be friends. It could be a taxi ride home where you don't get dropped off where you wanna be dropped off. I know of some girls whose parents are in recovery, or not in recovery, but who are sick too, who sold them when they were 11 to bikers. There's all kinds of reasons and why it happens, but what I would share, and escorting, let me just say a tiny little thing. There's this wonderful woman who's doing so well today whose mom was in a nursing home. This is an example how insidious the entry can be sometimes. She's lovely. She's as, what would you call her at school? Well, kids would say, you know, she's not in the cool group. She was a very straight, studious, not partying type of a girl, and her mom was in a nursing home, and finances to keep her in the nursing home, a nicer one, weren't there. And so she saw an ad in the paper for escorting, and she thought it meant taking people who didn't have anyone to go to the Flames games with. She could do that. She's super shy, but she could do that. And then she wasn't allowed to go. I mean, she was a really shy girl, so when the boss yelled at her, and I mean, she was really intimidated, and she ended up using crack cocaine just because she was so ashamed and felt so gross and became really addicted, and it took a long time to get out, but she's doing great. But she has strong passions when people say escorting isn't prostitution. She just hated herself. But where did I begin? I brought some of these for you. The women would write magazines called Cry of the Streets, and we would write them together. Just a few snippets. Where did I begin? As a child, I loved playing in the snow without a care in the world. I loved making snowmen and sledding. LR, initials. When I was a little girl, I wanted to be an art teacher, get married, and have babies. I wanted a white house. My dad said I always had a big mouth and I loved to argue, so I thought I'd make a great lawyer. When I was 7, all I dreamed of was a family and a home. When I was a little girl, I wanted to be a nurse. I also wanted to be Nadia Comaneci, because when I was really young, she was the best gymnast, and I thought I kind of looked like her. So those are the women who ended up in a really, really dark place. And then how they ended up in the pit, and that's my language for where the cry of the street ends. You know, you cry and you end up in such a dark place. This is from a girl who's doing really well now. The first time I actually got kicked out from my dad, I was 12. My mom called me a bad name, so I called her one back. As I did, my dad walked in the door. I remember seeing him and the anger in his face and turning and running up the stairs, trying to make it to my bathroom to lock the door. As I turned to shut the door, he was right behind me and flung the door open and backhanded me so hard I fell towards the tub and stopped myself on the ledge of the tub. I remember trying to get away. He took his belt off and started hitting me with the buckle end of it. I remember saying I was going to leave if he didn't stop, so he stopped and told me to go. I tried to grab some stuff, and he stopped me and told me to go with what I had on my back. So that's That's how it begins for some people. There's a girl who was so young, wrote, "Childhood should be filled with lots of love from parents. It should also be filled with laughter and lots of hugs and kisses, because that is all a child should have. If a child does not have a childhood, they do not have a wonderful life. Children deserve everything it takes to give a child to be happy, loved, and feel safe." So those are the kinds of stories that women wrote of their own experience. So how do people get out? That's what we're going to in this talk. There's Servants Anonymous is called Servants and Anonymous, which is, I think, sometimes people of different generations of servants talked about changing the name, and I always thought, no, like it is about servanthood, and it is about anonymity, respecting people's stories as their own. I think a friend of mine who is also doing very well wrote this. "I came to Servants in the summer of 2002. I had been clean, sober, and out of the sex trade for 18 months. In that time, I'd built a life I never dreamed possible. I had material possessions, my son was living with me, and I had just completed my first year of upgrading. In spite of all the good things happening in my life, I was struggling with wanting to go back to the sex trade. I was to be an advanced participant, in that I would attend full-time for the summer and return to school in September while attending the classroom part-time. I spent the first month fighting and arguing about everything we did," and she really did, "from sewing to movies," which we did crafts and we went to movies sometimes, that with the idea of just that's what we do, that's what people do. If you're bored, you get a hobby. You go to the movies and you just chill. It's okay to do that. "I couldn't understand the relevance of these things to my life. I was so naive, so tainted. I had spent the majority of my time there comparing servants to addiction treatment centers and was really confused because they are not the same. She wanted, like, fix me. Like, I'm here, I got to get to school. Just fix me in the next couple months. I thought myself to be above the trivial pursuits such as sewing and poetry. What am I supposed to do with this in the real world?" I asked. Towards the end of the summer in the classroom, it hit me. It hit me so hard, I was overwhelmed with sadness over the opportunity that I had squandered. The Ask classroom teaches women about dignity, integrity, love, community, and then shows them how to implement the teachings in their life. It's about lifestyle rehabilitation, which is what I needed. How do I integrate into society? How do I manage my financial matters so that I don't see prostitution as a choice? How do I take the simple joys in life and turn them into profound life lessons? How do I heal from my past so I can live a brighter day? What can I do for the next woman who walks through the doors? All of these questions were answered for me the moment I surrendered and appreciated the simplistic beauty of community. More than any imagery, I have heard past participants of SAS who made it describe the miracle as healing as pit stories. They often use the language of pit, a dark pit that I was in, and I was alone, and I was scared. Even trick pads are like a pit. You're locked in a basement for weeks, and people come and go, and you're in a pit, and you can't get out. And if you were to read lots of the Psalms, you could imagine a woman writing those as a journal rather than King David or the other authors of the Psalms. There was one girl who graduated who was really articulate about what it meant, that pit imagery, and she talked about, "I've been to so many treatment centers, everyone said, this is what you need to do to get well. Here's some financial planning. Here's self-esteem worksheets. We'll do them together. But here's the life skills that you need." And she said, "It always seemed like such a long journey up, one that I didn't think I could do. I just didn't think I had the skills to take people up on their advice." She said, "But at the Servants, people climbed down into the pit with me. And everybody got a little muddy. Because we did. And then when we climbed out, it didn't seem like such a long journey after all." And she talked about the day she did some job training afterwards, and she talked about her supervisor taking her to Starbucks because they're on their way to a meeting with some marketing person for some brochures. And the woman, the staff person, left her car running and the purse on the seat. And she said, "I made it." She sees me as a friend and a coworker. The keys are in the vehicle, the purse is open on the seat, and she's running to get us two lattes. And she goes, "That's what it meant for me," because we climbed out of the pit together, because they'd had some tough days. And it's the same for us. So where I want to get to in this talk is that when we go into the pit, we are open to being adjusted in our own sense of self. I remember, even before I worked at Servants, a professor from Regent College, I was picking him up at the airport, and it's different different kind of icky things were happening in life, and he said, "Oh, my dear Heidi, the effort you go to avoid the pit." And he said, "You avoid intimacy with God. You go to great lengths to avoid it. But if only you would let yourself go into the pit, because that's where all your troubles are, and just be there, you would find Jesus' arms waiting for you to embrace you." And that seemed scary to me. So I was thinking, I did learn what it meant to go into the pit when I went to Servants, and maybe that's why I liked working there so much. And I wondered, how did it actually happen? Like, it's great to say journey with people and get into it with each other. I think it's very much about Matthew 25 and changing our posture and how we see people. God, I think, is embodied in relationships where brokenness and love exist. And that means we bring that too. So we need to be prepared to extend hospitality in the pit. And that means we can't be just well-meaning nice people, because we are well-meaning nice people. But we can't shout our ideas down from the rim of the pit. That's not going to be enough. I was wanting to write about this so much that it was welling up in me over the years, and I did write in one of those weavings journals, and I just want to read a little bit because I struggled over how to say it. A quote from one of the women: "It's cold, freezing cold. I can't feel my feet. My hands are on fire. I'm starving. I haven't eaten in 3 days. I'm thirsty. I can't remember the last time I had something to drink. I'm weak. I can barely walk. I'm so shaky. I've been on the same street on and off for at least 3 days. A car stops. I use my last bit of strength to run and smile. And then I do it again." This lament was written by a woman I picked up from jail one snowy night. She'd spent years of her young life in prostitution, violence, and addiction. When we'd safely navigated the black ice on Calgary streets to arrive at SAS, we were in the Northwest, and we had this blue van, and she slunk down in the seat, and she had her hood up, and she was really scared. She kind of scanned the street from the iced-up windows, looked at our houses, and said that before jail, she hadn't been allowed outside except to work, had not been to a mall or to a grocery store. She was terrified, I remember, on our first day when we went to the gym, because she was going to have to drive down a little bit of 9th Avenue. 2 years after that trip from jail, she wrote what I just read. When we wrote on Mondays in our writing class, I was always amazed that a lot of what the women wrote sounded like lament psalms. Their writings talked about the despair of the weight of poverty, of being trapped, hungry, diseased, afraid, and above all shunned, and pleading for release. They lamented their lost childhoods. They lamented their own hurtful choices made in response to not knowing their worth. And they were really brokenhearted. Psalm 34:18 says, "The Lord is close to the brokenhearted and saves those who are crushed in spirit." And I think that God places a high value on the poor and the brokenhearted, people who are powerless. And the poor are those who have nothing left to lose, because they in fact have nothing. Which made it really interesting to work with women who just put their whole selves out there. They weren't protecting that last little shred of anything. Old Testament prophetic texts in Isaiah and Jeremiah are rich with God's desire to rescue the poor and brokenhearted. The very ill, widows, orphans, prostitutes, those who are in jail, those who suffer from mental illness, or who have hearts so broken that they have no self-will to live at all. These are the poor. Their well-being is dependent on the actions of society, the powerful. The poor, no powerlessness, and sexually exploited women are lived examples of whom God considers to be poor. And I learned from the women at Servants that this powerlessness can be experienced as being unrecognized. These are the dolls that Hannah and Michaela and Natalie showed me. Or as deep shame, which undermine the dignity of being a valuable human being. Despair is what makes their cry of the street so shrill or so very, very quiet. Not even a mouth to open. You have to listen really hard sometimes for the cry of the street. They could relate to Psalm 142's cry attributed to David when he was hiding. David says, "No one cares for my life." Likewise, Psalm 143 could easily be the writings of a woman who felt crushed to the ground by her pursuer, forced to dwell in darkness like those already dead. When weeping in the dark, their plea is that the morning will bring a new reality, that the night will not be repeated. The psalm reads just like that. And I would read their writings and go, whoa, you could interchange them. The psalmist fears God will hide his face and that the pit will become his reality. Women suffering in the sex trade can relate. Indeed, many of the Psalms are about being trapped in the pit, and many of the women, as I said, use pit language when they describe their journey of being released from poverty of mind, body, and spirit. They have not read the Psalms, yet they speak the language. So how do we respond to these cries from the street, from the pit? I learned a lot from reading women mystics, so I didn't have any school type stuff, but these were my teachers. Has anyone heard of Catherine of Siena? She's lovely. She's a 14th century feisty woman. I think she's the 25th of 26 children. She said, I don't think I'll get married. I see my future and I don't think it sounds good. I think I'll cut my hair and lock myself in a small room in the house until my family gets used to the idea that I don't see that happening for me. So she was illiterate until all of a sudden she wasn't. So it's kind of one of the miracles attributed to her. She was a peacemaker for kings and popes. She was their consultant. They would call for her. This illiterate, kind of rude woman. One of her famous phrases was, "Get up and be a man," to both popes and kings. And it's pretty bold for an illiterate woman. What I learned from Catherine was she used to give bread anonymously in the morning. She'd get up really early and deliver bread to people. She didn't want them to be embarrassed. And I think we like sometimes to give things and get a thank you note later and we did really well. And Catherine didn't need any thank you. She wanted to make sure people didn't know it was her. She used to visit this old woman named Andrea who was really sick with some kind of gross, pussy wound. And Andrea didn't let anyone visit her, but she really needed help. So sometimes when people are hurt, I don't know if you've ever found this, they do a lot of things to push you away. Because if I don't like myself, I do that. I do things to self-fulfill. So I know you won't like me, so if I act this way, I know what you're going to do. And then we can be done with this. So Catherine's response to Andrea was to, I don't know if I'm going to do this. I hope it's not too offensive, but I'm going to. She drank Andrea's pus. So it's like, there's nothing that's going to push me away from you. There's nothing about you that is so ugly that I can't handle it, because I know my own ugliness too. So let's just get this over with. Like, so stop it. So I immediately liked her. I immediately thought, you're cool. And one of the most important things I learned from Catherine of Siena is her idea was that she felt so loved by God that the only way to love God back was to love people like Andrea, who didn't feel very lovable. And I thought that was really intriguing. I always like helping people because it makes me feel really good when they get well and they do great and they say, I couldn't have done it without Heidi. You know, that feels awfully good. But Catherine of Siena said, that's not real love because I'm already getting something back from you. Did anybody ever like this will date some of us, but Friends, do you know that episode where Phoebe and Joey, you're nodding, are trying to figure out if it's actually possible to give a gift, like without getting anything back? So pure altruism. And they were trying to prove to each other that it's not possible because it feels good every time you do something good. So Catherine, she should have been on Friends or something. So her big thing was, it's nothing to do with the person I'm helping. It's all a love response back to God. So the only way I can love God the way I've been loved is to love other people who don't feel lovable. And usually people who don't feel lovable are really difficult to be around. So that was her big thing. And I learned from that, this is so powerful, that that takes a huge burden off the receiver. Because if we're all putting our best effort into helping sexually exploited boys and girls and women and men who are now 50 and even harder to help, the pressure on the receiver to make it, because for all the resources we've put in, after all the time we've showed up for, all the Tuesdays we did math together, especially if you've been sexually exploited, you're really good at pleasing people. You're really good at figuring out what it's going to take to keep a roof over your head. You want me to be a Christian? I'm a Christian. You want me to write my GED? I'll show up for that. Like, but what's authentic and what's pressure? And I know you need to feel good about what you're doing, so there's a lot of work that goes into being present to people. And usually people who have been hurt are really, really good at it. So Catherine's way frees people up because it's not actually about you. You can be mad, you can have a bad day, you can tell me to off or whatever. It's not a reflection on how I'm doing or I'll still show up tomorrow. So that's what I really, really needed, to take the pressure off people who are needing to heal. feels counterintuitive. But I think it also allows the person who's broken to realize they have everything inside them already to know what to do to get well. It gives them some credit. It's respectful. It's not rocket science to figure out you need to learn to make a budget to spend your money. It's not that difficult. So there's a reason for the behavior. There's a reason for people resisting taking you up on the skills that you're offering them, because it's worked for them. And maybe it's going to work for them to stay in kind of a bad state for a while because they're scared. So just taking the agenda away and letting them figure out, I'm ready now. Yeah, and I can figure out how to balance a budget or show up for work on time. I can do that. Julina F. Norwich, some of you might know of her. I used to hide in the bathroom at Servant sometimes when I just didn't know what to do, when it was really not going well and I wasn't doing that well at things. And I would go, what would Julian say? She'd say, and all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well. And God made it, and God cared for it, and God will protect it. Go back in. You know, just this different type of wisdom. Not like, okay, I have to do a better job. I've got to say something different. Just go back in and just be peaceful. Clara of Assisi used to wash the feet of her sisters. And she was in a position of power. So what does it mean? Just to get rid of some of the power things. Just to be seen to be the one that's cleaning the bathroom and filling the coffee pot. There's no job that anybody else can't do. And I also learned about how to be in the pit from the way Jesus behaved. He gave hope to the powerlessness and brokenhearted by identifying with them, naming his very presence with them. I am the poor. I am like you. I am with you, and with you is where I choose to be. I am not scared of your story, and I am not scared of your sadness. So I think God's solidarity with the poor is affirmed that in Jesus' very birth comes through a young pregnant girl and a carpenter from a powerless region. They are chosen to be by God to be family with God's son, to share meals with him, to create home with him, and to belong to each other. Jesus' incarnation is about the elimination of human isolation through community and an end to suffering that comes when we recognize ourselves in each other and Christ as wounded healer there with us too. One of the things I wanted to say is, I don't get that sense from this community, but lots of times at Servants I would see faith communities wanting to help, and one of the prerequisites that is that we do some sort of Bible study or integrate spirituality into our program. And I always suggest that maybe there is a different agency in Calgary that folks could volunteer at. Because when you've been hurt, like I said, you'll do whatever it takes to keep yourself safe. It's called resiliency. And so in our effort to give people what's been really good for us, we haven't stopped to listen to them what they need. And if we'd stop to listen, we'd realize that oftentimes some of the hurt to a young boy or girl has been at the hands of a father. So when we talk about, go sit on your father's knee and he will comfort you, that's absolutely terrifying. I don't want to hear about a powerful, in our Christian language, an all-powerful father. But what if your all-powerful father was really scary and was part of the hurt part? Or lots of girls came from a cult background. So we just can't know. And so it's really important to, again, adjust our own identity and things that are important to us and make room for someone else. And the other thing I wanted to say is about eating together. I learned that being in the pit together was sharing meals. We used to have meals together at least once a week, and I remember one day everyone bought pie. We had 20 pies for supper. And that was fun, and we all had a good laugh. And I was thinking about Jesus saying, I am food, like I am bread. And so that's the way we bring our spirituality, is when we eat together, we're a community, we're the same. Everyone's bringing something. We're eating what each other made, and the food food is God, and so we're nourished in community, and we're nourished by the food itself because people are needing some better nutrition, and it's spiritual. So, bottom line, what I'm trying to say is that the way we come alongside people to help is really important, more than anything else about skills or programs. Another friend who's doing well wrote, for me, it was a feeling of aloneness in the world. I grew up feeling out of place, an outsider, and I always struggled to find a place where I belonged. I always maintained that one of my best traits was to be able to assimilate into a great variety of people. I came to realize that I didn't have a true identity because I was looking to fit in anywhere that anyone would have me. So no true identity. It took me quite a lot of time to accept that having someone believe in me and tell me that I have a place here, even though they weren't taking something from me in return, was true. I want to say a little bit about belonging. Belonging is about being recognized, no longer invisible, no longer faceless. Have you ever read Christine Pohl's book? Anybody? This is a really good book. Nope, it's this one. Oh, it's in my bag. It's all right. Christine Pohl, it's all right. Thank you. It's called Making Room, and I think it's, you know, required reading for anybody who wanted to do this kind of helping. But she talks about small acts of respect and valuing potential contributions is how people come to know that they have dignity. And this, she says, is the transformative power of hospitality. And that would be my experience too. Such things say to people, we are waiting for you. I always had this idea and would tell the women at Servants, the world's waiting for your contribution. Like, it's not going to be right until you're able to make it. Like, it's needed. It's not just icing. Like, the world will be what it's supposed to be when you give your gift. One aspect of belonging that's easy to forget when we're trying to help people is that contributing is really important. It's really hard to always be on the receiving end. And the focus is on the receiver then. The people who are receiving need to be able to give back. There's a few aspects of belonging, and one is naming someone. Like when they're ready to have their name. Like, I know who you are, I see you, I like you, I don't like you. You know, that's part of it too. And claiming, saying, I'm yours, you're mine, I've got your back, you've got my back. It's not just a project, you're not a project. You're not something that I can check off my list. And it's about enjoying each other. At Servants, we would, and still now, I haven't been there for some time, but we still go to birthday parties. We still meet for lunch. Some people you end up having something in common with, you go to an art class together or a movie. It's about having fun with each other, not because you have to, because you want to. And needing that contribution again. That's the nice part of being kind of the mutuality pit thing. There's some things that are hard. I remember one volunteer saying they'd done a lot of work to fix up one of our houses. New blinds, new countertops, painted, everything was lovely. And within about 8 months, it looked really crappy. There were kettle burns on the counter. The blinds were kind of broken and twisted. She was really discouraged. And she said, you know, her church had spent a lot of time fundraising and then volunteering their man hours to get that house looking nice. And she's saying, we're wondering if we should do that again. And I said, I think it would be really good if you did, because what's important is that you keep doing it, but budget for every eight months, we're going to do a makeover. Because when you feel ugly, you need everything around you to look the same, because then you feel at home. And so if you don't value yourself, you don't dress well, you don't eat well, you don't clean your house. And so a lot of the women could talk for half an hour about beauty. And when you don't feel beautiful, you need everything around you to be ugly. That's why some of the behaviors or words or language, they're ugly. And they want it to be affirmed that, yep, you're ugly. And so when a group of volunteers comes back and fixes the house, it says no. It says, I'm in the pit with you and I don't agree. I see someone really beautiful and you deserve to have walls that are bright and clean. So let's clean them up again. You'd always notice the girls who are ready to graduate, we're always really angry at the new girls. Like, put your stuff away, do the dishes. I'm tired of coming home to a sink full of dishes. Clean up the bathroom, this is a sty. And it was good because they're starting to feel good about themselves. But it was a worthwhile fight with volunteers, with new participants, just a fight for beauty. That's part of it. Another story, this girl I can say her name because she wrote this a little bit about herself. Her name was Liz, and she didn't live. She had this frizzy red hair, and she had a great belief that no one wanted to be friends with her. Her face would just show it in class. She spent the first month at Servants with her hoodie up and her eyes looking straight at the table. And one day, a staff member made quite a big mistake with her. Just one of those things that we say and do that wasn't okay, and we all make mistakes. And so I called the staff member, and we talked to her, and she said, yeah, I did do that, and I wish I wouldn't have. So why don't you come in and apologize to Liz, and we'll have a meeting. And she was really scared to do that because it was really embarrassing. And Liz didn't think that that it would happen, that the staff person would show as a person who lived in one of the houses. So she wasn't on site usually. But Liz thought the power gradient would be so great that, you know, she's not really going to say sorry because I'm just a participant. So the person came and she said sorry and her face was bright red and she was horrified. They made amends. And after that, Liz's face was up and she didn't look at her desk anymore and her hoodie was off. And I remember her twirling around the classroom at Christmas. She had a dress on. She was spinning. Her frizzy red hair was like whoosh. And I knew that Liz now felt respected and recognized. And she was free to enjoy who she was. It was a really, really, really neat picture. Would you put the homelessness? I should have done that one before. This is just a cute cartoon. But what I want to say, it's about friendship. I like that. So when we think we're going to help someone and instead we see a little bit of ourselves in there. You know, when we feel like Liz, when I feel like someone probably wouldn't bother saying sorry to me because they have more power than I do. Or, when I don't feel beautiful, can I look in the mirror of someone look in the face of someone who needs help and go, I see myself there. And then the way you help ends up being quite different. So I think it's about friendship. There's a girl named Nancy who also didn't live, and she was such a gentle soul. She reminded me of a deer. She had these big brown eyes, and she used to like to talk about braiding her children's hair who weren't with her girls, and she got visits sometimes. And she was so soft that the whole classroom got softer when she was in program. And she wrote this poem. Here I go again, feel that I'm all alone, not knowing who I am or where to go. I need to feel loved and cared for. I want you to know who I am. If you could walk in my shoes, how would you cope with my life? I feel like a child again, not knowing how to feel. I want and need to find a peace of mind. I know I've got a beautiful heart and soul. Please walk with me so I can feel secure in myself. I'm calling out to God above to take my hand and be my soulmate. So I was thinking that pretty much says it, that God invites us to embody God's mercy, to be his hands and feet and take a hand and to know that we're not that different and to climb down into a pit with someone, to lift chins, to let God smile friendship through us. To weep together if we need to tend to the wound, and then to climb out and have dinner together. That would be a good thing to do. When I look at the picture there, I was thinking, what's another way of saying, how do I get in the pit? And I have this great Raku angel that my husband bought me, and I think she's marvelous. And does anyone know about the process of Raku? Yeah? Yeah? Well, because you're part of me talking. Yeah.
So how Raku works is that you take a bisque piece of clay, and then you put glaze on it, and you bring it up to temperature, and when it's up to temperature, you put it in a trash can with the trash.
Yeah.
And then you put the lid on it, and the smoke and the trash burns all around it, and it becomes beautiful.
That's awesome. That's way better than, you put the lid on the trash can and you turn the heat up and the lid doesn't get to come off. And then clay is transformed into these beautiful shimmering colors. And I liked this angel because she's like powerful. Like she's not like a nice little meek angel. She's like got attitude. And I like that she's colorful because she's felt like garbage and she emerged from the fire beautiful. And I think that's what it means to be in the pit, is to stay in the fire with the lid on and not leave even when you feel like trash. And then I broke her to make matters worse. Her story was already, you know, tough when I got her. And I was watering the plants one day and my elbow knocked her off and I saw in slow motion my favorite angel was cracked. And I came home, I was really, really upset, and Mike was gluing her together. My kind of tough husband who doesn't get all emotional about things. And he was sitting there gluing tiny pieces in. There's lots in the back that are so small. And then he said, I'm going to paint her when we're done. I said, no. I would like for her fractures to show. Because I was learning from servants and my own life, some things that happened in my life, that God meets me at the place of my wounds, that my scars are sacramental in the sense that that's where God has been. Yeah, yeah.
Can you talk about the gold pottery stuff? Do you know? But you can talk about it without naming it, right? You know? I'm putting her on the spot. I can do it if you don't want to.
Yeah, would you please? Because
Yeah. So there's a Japanese pottery technique where they take broken pottery and then they do the same thing, but they do it with gold. I forget what the name of it is, but it's actually the finished pieces, the broken finished pieces repaired with gold are way more beautiful than they were to start with. So sorry to put you on the... Yeah, like our peace pole, too, that happened with our outside on the street. The young people made a peace post, and they put around the top of it the colors of the peace flag, which are being used by the Pride movement, so we know them as the rainbow. And on Pride weekend last year, that pole was defaced on all four sides, spray painted black, and ripped out of the ground. And the young people, it was the most amazing thing because they didn't get mad. They just started talking about why people do that and why people have those kind of reactions. And we had this great conversation about what it means to stand for something and how, like, not everyone likes it when you do that.
They don't, no.
And their next step with the peace pole was to, it got cleaned up somewhat, but they decided not to restore it to its original beauty. So it's lovely. There enough that you could read it. Like if you were just passing by, you might think, well,
yeah,
that's kind of a crappy looking pole. But then they had that pole joined by three other poles that have the colors that you could see all the colors of the rainbow no matter which way you're standing around that. And so that's what's in the garden now is the peace pole sort of restored and then these new poles.
That's perfect. I mean that we bring in the dark things and the broken things. And Nancy Kwan, who's my friend who came to enjoy with us today, she's the director of campus ministry at St. Mary's and they have the St. John's Bible there. And we went to Minnesota together a few years ago. And they use real gold. Have you seen the St. John's Bible? That would be a neat Saturday morning for you. And so real gold, you can probably explain it better, but it's to symbolize the presence of the divine. And all, so it's an illuminated Bible with the first handwritten Bible since the monastic times on calfskin. And it's quite a process, but the piece that's interesting with what you said is a lot of the pictures or illuminations are contemporary pictures of very, very dark things associated with our era, and then there's gold all through it, real gold. So these are good things. These are good images to have with us when we see each other, that we're the same and we're broken and it's a bit ugly and it's absolutely beautiful all at the same time. So I thought I would say just a tiny bit about what it was like for, not all my whole story, but little pieces of the ways my identity was altered by being in the pit with women at Servants. Some of it was really substantial on core level childhood issues and all those things that 15 years later you're going, oh, thank you for pushing me to do that work. But some of them are just really just about being human. One of the ways that everyone copes differently. One of the ways that I made sure life went well from early childhood on was by being really good at things, by being really efficient and productive and making sure everything went well for everyone. And that's where my identity came from. I was a good girl, my parents were happy, all the little things that happen in life didn't have to be attended to too much because I just made sure things went well. Inside, I know that I wondered, would I still be loved if I wasn't good at making sure everything went well? If I didn't do what was expected and do a good job of that, keeping peace at home or going with the flow, even if things wouldn't have been a good idea to do that. I never risked the pit. I never risked saying no or just being me sometimes. So when I went to SAS, where I really had nothing to offer that would alter the situation of the 13 women sitting around this smoke-filled boardroom table, it was awful. I used to go home at night and like prepare a class, and it'd be paper all over the bed, and Mike, I'd say, don't move, don't roll, like, I've got to make sure tomorrow goes well, I've got a great class prepared. And then I would go into class and the girls would say, well, this sucks, what do you want us to do with this? And then they called a meeting, and the meeting was about, why is she here? And I had to sit there while they discussed, why is she here? Like, who told her that she should be a volunteer or staff person? And it was like, wow, I can't believe this is happening. Like, I just quit my job, and this is really not going well. So I went and talked to Carla, my boss, and she said, oh, this is perfect. So this is perfect, because the more useless you are, the more you have to offer. And I was like, oh, I'm not used to that feeling. I'm used to, like, you know, being promoted and people writing letters about how great this project went. Instead, they had a meeting about why I was here and what a waste of time that was. And she said, no, really, their whole life, they're actually living. They're actually making it and not leaving and exiting and being back out there and maybe dying. Depends on you showing up, being useless. That's what I want you to do. Because if you aren't good at things, you make it possible for them to realize that it's okay. Because they don't feel like they're good at anything. They're not. They have no skills, no talents that they've discovered. They never got that soccer award. They never got the honor roll. They never got a parent showing up at some school play where they had one line or they were a tree or a candle. That never happened. So there's no identity that they can hang their hat on. So when you come up and it bombs class after class, and I wanted productive. I wanted, we have 13 women who are here for 6 months. If everyone has one good experience once a week, or I had once a day was my first goal, then everyone's going to start feeling better. And then I changed it to one good experience once a week for each girl. And then I changed it to one good experience for one girl once a week. And then I just gave up. Like, and so I just showed up, and it really wasn't going that well. And then it did go well. And it was when I stopped needing people to do well. Because that was really all about me. I needed them to do well, so my identity would continue to be furthered. And instead, I learned that was my first pit experience. There was this girl, I'm not going to swear here, but you can fill in the blanks. I used to start my morning, and she'd go, don't even look at me, Heidi. Has two syllables, starts with an F. Every morning started like that. And I would come in all keen, get my coffee, and that's how I began. And then all the girls were staring, you know, and I'd be like, oh, so bad. And then one day we got into it. It got big. She's screaming. And she goes, I hate the way you smile when you're mad. And I was like, what are you talking about? She goes, I talked to you like that, and you just smile and go, that's not, you know, let's not talk that way with each other. Or like whatever, I don't know what I would say. She goes, I'm rude, and I'm calling you down, and you smile. And it annoys me to no end, and that's why I hate you. I was like, well, that's fair. Like, well, it was a little over the top, but it's not authentic to smile when someone's not being respectful or kind. So I'm always grateful to her because I got more mad at servants than I have in anywhere in my life, and it was fine. It was fun, like, to be more real and not try to be nice to everyone so that everything would go well. And then that freed the girls up to do what they needed to do. Because when you're rude, you're probably going to get a rude response back in life. And I learned to be more authentic, and we actually became really, really close eventually when I started being more authentic. There was another woman who was trying to legitimately get her kids back, and she needed to write a letter, but she didn't know how to write an essay. So, and she'd done all the right things. And I wrote the letter, and she wouldn't finish it. She wouldn't finish proofing it, and I was getting so frustrated, and I kept saying, you know, the court date's coming up soon, we need to get this in. And one day she just took it and she ripped it up and threw it in my face. If it's so important to you, you sign it. And I went, oh, this was not, this is her story, not my story. I needed to not do that. Yeah. And another girl wouldn't do chores. It was a carpet like this, the boardroom table took up the whole place. It was like a simple vacuum. And she wouldn't vacuum, and she was ready to graduate, and I wanted her to have all the things she deserved. But if she was going to not vacuum, I knew the other staff were going to give her a written warning, and then she wouldn't graduate. And I really needed her to vacuum, and she wouldn't vacuum. So I remember writing on a little sticky, just do the chore, like you're going to get a written warning. And she took it, and she did. She ripped it and went in my face. And I went, oh, if I'd have listened to her, I'd have realized she doesn't want to graduate. Maybe she's scared. I'm putting pressure on her because I need her to graduate because we worked so hard together. She needs to do what she needs to do. She talked about later, when we talked about it a year later, I used to not come home at night. I used to be late and no one said anything. She's 12. Then I used to come home at 1 and no one said anything. By the time I was 13, I didn't come home at all and nobody said anything. I really needed you to give me that written warning that year. I needed to be not invisible anymore. I needed to be noticed, even if it's not over good things. Don't lower the bar for me, because then you're telling me I can't do it. So I was being a jerk. Like, everyone else is vacuuming. Like, who did I think I was? I needed you to call me on it. Otherwise, I'd be too scared to graduate. Okay. So learning, to stop people-pleasing, to stop needing people to do well, because then I would feel better, and realizing that that's when the real intimate friendships occurred, when I stopped doing that. Okay. I'll just say a couple more things. There's a wonderful writer named Miroslav Volf. He talks about the will to give ourselves to others and to welcome them, to readjust our identities and make space for them prior to any judgment, except identifying them in their humanity. And I guess for me, that's everything. It is about being open to mutual transformation. I would ask you just to take a moment for yourself and think about mutual transformation when the one you think you're going to help is actually drawing you into God's presence. So I would just ask you just to take a private moment or talk to the person beside you. Who made room for you in your life? Can you think of a time when a guest or a stranger drew you into God's presence? There's a couple ways to come at it. Sometimes I think, is there a time I felt excluded, in need of healing? And what did someone do to make room for you? And what does that even mean? Did they try to fix you? Or did they instead remove some of the things that set you apart? And what were those things? And did they make it clear by their eyes or their words or their invitation to sit down that they found you interesting or your contribution valued? Did you feel recognized? I think taking an intentional stance of mutuality and being open to meeting God in the encounter with the person we are helping is what it's all about. Meeting the divine in our neighbor is a transformational encounter. That's what I think happens when we go into the pit with someone. No one comes out the same. We emerge from the pit with our scars shining. I was thinking about the Raku again. There's the scripture from Isaiah, "He who created you, O Jacob, he who formed you, O Israel, do not fear, for I have redeemed you. I have called you by name. You're not faceless anymore. You are mine. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you. Through the rivers, they will not overflow, and your dress will stay on. When you walk through the fire, you'll not be scorched, nor will the flame burn you." And in Genesis, remember God says, "Your name shall no longer be Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed." So I think when we stay in the pit, with the fire and the heat and the lid on, and we feel like trash, whether we're the helper or the receiver, that's where transformation happens. Would you be able to show the... This is an artist called Charles Maxey. I have pictures of these sorts of things in our house. So he draws over and over again pictures of the prodigal son and of women, the prodigal daughter. And what's interesting about his pictures is, when they've been analyzed or you read his artist statements, is that the posture of the adult being held by the prodigal father is that of a child. Like, that adult don't actually bend the way the bending's happening. I think there's one more after it. So that one is the one we have in our house, the gold one. And what he's written is the Luke story in his own words on top of the canvas. This is the story of the prodigal daughter. It should really be called the father running, the father who was looking for her every day and for his girl to return home. And when he saw her, you know, he ran from a long way off. And she's all bent like a baby. And so I'm thinking, when we're in the pit with each other, we go to help someone and we hold each other and we let ourselves be held. I've been held by people when I thought I was going to go help them. So I really like his pictures. And I would end with a song. This song is by Goo Goo Dolls. It's probably one of my favorite songs. And it's called Name. And I just invite you to meditate on the words. The words show on the speaker. It reminds me of the women and what it's like to live this way together, and it's a good way to live. All good. Thank you. So I think that's why I really love these dolls that you guys made, that we get a new name when people come alongside and let us figure out a new identity after we've been through the fire. And God says, I was always with you. And then we discover that God was with us through the people that were in the fire with us and didn't leave, even if it meant that they came out a little bit scarred as well. I like that, I won't tell them your name. You're discovering your new name, so I'll let you tell your own story. Betty Jane and I were talking before. Don't tell stories for people. You grew up way too fast, and now there's nothing to believe. Thinking about the words of the one younger girl who wrote, what kids need lots of love. And if you grow up too fast without love, it's hard to know what to believe. And so it links back to belonging, about what we believe in our identities. They come to flourish when we belong. And in relationship where you belong, your identity will be revealed and you won't be faceless anymore and nameless. And those last lines, I'm thinking about different women that are, you know, in Montreal going to university, and some who are, quite a few are deceased. I think about you all the time, and I won't tell anyone your name. That's it. Thank you.
Heidi has graciously offered to answer any questions you might have. But I have a microphone that I'm going to hand to you so that everyone can hear you. First question is the hardest, so I have it. How do people come to the program? How do they?
Oh, that's a really good question. So I'm speaking for the servants of my era. I'm not sure how it goes now, but we were really committed to not going out to get people, which was really hard when someone exited and you're worried, because you have to be at the right time. So we were very much word of mouth, so people in recovery would know where our building was and what our phone number was. And so it was all self-referral, and including not sending a ride for someone, which was really difficult sometimes. Say you've worked really hard to survive. So to get yourself from wherever you are to 9th Avenue, or when we were on 7th, that's going to be really important. That we wouldn't say this on the front end, but on the days that were really bad and this isn't fun anymore and I hate this place and I don't like any of you, you need to remember how hard you worked to get here that day. So if we go do it for you, it sets a tone right off the bat of, we don't think you can do it. We're going to come and get you. We're going to fix you. But rather, we're waiting for you. Coffee's on. We're right here. So if a social worker or a probation officer or a nurse called, we'd need the woman to get on the phone herself and say, would you have a place for me? So not to be arranged. In fact, we remember we asked a really, really good judge who was very, very supportive of the women to stop writing on the orders, the court orders, that they needed to be at servants in order to have their conditions. Because when it got bad, it was, well, I have to be here. Judge said I had to if I want continued whatever. It's like, no, you need to choose to be here. So, that's what we did. Hi.
I just wanted to reflect on how much your talk means to me, and one of the things that I found really, really helpful is this idea of being useless.
Hmm.
I think it's a quality I still feel in my life a lot. And I kind of treasure it, because I think it'll be a bridge between me and someone else.
Hmm.
And so you're talking about that really helped me.
I'm glad.
It's been really such a meaningful experience that you'd... that you talk about what you're doing, how you're doing it, and what it's meant to you. So
it's been a gift to learn that it's okay to be useless sometimes. Have you ever read Jean Vanier? Do you know?
Yeah, you know what? I was thinking about him all the time you were talking, because I'm in love with Jean Vanier.
No doubt. Yeah, me too.
He came to St. Mary's years ago, and I hadn't gotten tickets, and I wanted to see him so badly. My life depended on it. So I met I said to somebody, "Will you just let me come? I have to see him. I have to see him." And the gentleman who was organizing it said, "Yeah, okay." And so it even helped more kind of fuel the flame I have inside for Jean and the work he does. And I just really thought of him as you were talking a lot.
I always thought, you know, I'm not there anymore, but I always thought as a pre-staff volunteer orientation support would be to read at least one of Vanier's books or listen to one of his talks, because he understands what it means to, and now and as well, I mean, to be with people who are seen by society as having nothing to offer, and realizing that they're our best teachers, and we're privileged to be in their company. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Heidi, as long as I've known you, and today I'm reminded again, what I have loved so much about you is how open you are about yourself, how willing you are to share your own life, how you actually talk about your own journey into the pit. And I just want to thank you for that. And I also want to say I am so very grateful that you left the Cattlemen's Association. She worked for the Cattlemen's Association during the BSE crisis. This is the best move I've ever heard of.
Thanks, Betty Jane.
You have talked about a variety of ways, or talked about volunteering. So I'm just curious, what are the ways people can get involved if they want to volunteer? Are there ways, or is it more of a,
you know, because
like
I'm
it's
not
fairly
there
intense, yeah,
as much anymore. My relationship now is with past participants, and it's in, well, I mean, you can always call down and ask, and there's lots of ways. I mean, there's childcare, and there's for people who are over 18, staying at the houses is so great. I didn't talk about the fact that the SAS houses are staffed, I don't like that term, by volunteers unpaid 24/7. So there's no shift work, which, and I remember different comings and goings of different boards and executive directors, that was always rediscussed. And I was like, die on that hill of, I mean, I had some, I didn't read everything I had brought, but there were some quotes from women who said, this was the first time I had a lock on my door and a fridge, and that no one was being paid to have me there. So sometimes when the organization would look at, we should probably be paying live-ins, they work really hard. Or there needs to be more, a bit more like a group home where there's shifts and people, and it's like, no. It's okay to be tired. This is a calling, a vocation, whether someone's religious or not. That's less important that someone not be paid to have you stay overnight. If you're a girl who's been sexually exploited, there's always been money changing hands. You're probably in a group home or foster care, so someone was paid, probably a really nice person, to have you there. It's not real belonging like what I was trying to share, where someone just enjoys you, needs you there, like a member of the family. You didn't get that for whatever reason. So we can't pay our live-ins. They need to choose to be there, and live-ins furthermore agree to the same rules. So no friends dropping by. So if you become a volunteer live-in, you're not having your friend drop by for coffee. Definitely not for a glass of wine. So it's a huge lifestyle choice, and that's helpful to the women to go, so it's, the rules aren't that hard that you're imposing on me. And the rules are there because it's going to help you get well. And if it's going to help you get well, I'm willing to adapt, choose to adapt, so that we can do that together. So that's the biggest volunteer opportunity. And giving relief to live-ins is a great one to say, just do the orientation, say I'm up for someone just wants to go visit a family member, just needs a weekend away. It's really nice to have a roster of relief live-ins. Tutoring for school, going to the pool with kids so that someone can study or just have a little bit of respite. In the classroom, there's lots of classes that need someone to just be there. Just whatever we're doing, having a second or third person there to help is great. But again, I'm saying I'm not there anymore, but I know that those needs are still there. But there's also lots of past participants now who could use, their kids could use help with homework. There's all kinds of little concrete things. Yeah. I could give the information later if anyone's interested of who's running it now and ask them. But they're lovely.
On the website, there's ways of helping by raising money.
and that too.
You know, they do toques, and I mean, I volunteered, so I know they do toques, and they've got different things that they're raising money and trying to help with different areas. So if you ever go on the website, it'll be there.
Great idea. And there'll be lots of Christmas presents to wrap soon. You know what we really read right now, a past participant, just plug out there in terms of volunteering. There's a woman who did extraordinarily well. She worked, held a job, finished school, was in the process of raising her four kids, and things aren't going well for her now. Someone else is looking after kids, and I've got them in school, but doesn't have a dryer. So just looking to get a dryer for them. So that's a little thing, but if you pass the word, we need a dryer. So that's a current, not a volunteer need, but, and that's the kind of community that, you know, years later, past staff, kids can come live with, figure out where mom is, something bad's happened. I'll just stay with you for a while, not say your name, but yeah.
Thank you very much, Heidi. What a pleasure to be with you. And I invite you to all let the pleasure continue. We have lots of food and coffee and drinks, and Heidi will be out there, and we'll all be out there, and let's just have a nice time together.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Yeah.